Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This podcast is with our old friend from Smash Hits, Neil Tennant, and we talked for so long and about so much, the pop press, his early recordings, people he'd met or interviewed, that we're putting it out in two parts. Do go back and hear part one, it's well worth it. Here, recorded in a slightly echoey but atmospheric room in London's Somerset House, is the second half.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
We were talking about this the other day. You mentioned it. The gay thing in the 80s, in the early 80s, was not front of mind at all, was it? Well, was it?
Well,
I don't remember it ever being talked about in the Smash Hits.
Well, identity...
Go on.
...wasn't
no.
a thing in the 80s. Nowadays we live in an era obsessed with identity, and almost like micro-identity, which we sort of find mildly embarrassing, but self-victimising yourself, if that's the right word. You know, in the 80s, that just didn't exist. I've seen people online saying, aren't you ashamed that you never had anyone black on the cover of Smash Hits?
Not true.
Really?
Yeah. And I immediately thought, I wasn't participating in this discussion, otherwise I would have said this, but...
Not true as well.
But either one, not true. Two, you had to be a pop star. Who were the black pop stars? Well, firstly, the Specials. I, of course, my third cover feature was the Fun Boy 3, two of them were black and they were on the front cover.
Yeah.
Although, did we just put Terry Hall on the front cover?
No.
There was one time when all three of them were, and then there was one time with Terry Hall.
Terry Hall with
the big
the pop book of lists were written.
Yeah.
That's right, yeah.
Lynx, you were a huge fan of Lynx.
Yeah, Lynx. Well, Musical Youth.
Donald Summer. I mean, if you look very early Smash Hits, Bob Marley's on the cover.
Yeah.
You know, Michael Jackson on the cover.
Yeah. Of course, we did put Michael Jackson on the cover anyway. Your famous interview. Did we put him on
the
cover?
Do you know, that wasn't on the cover.
It wasn't, actually.
And I'll tell you why. Because it was in the autumn of 1982, we weren't 100% convinced it was going to be a huge hit. We had no idea. We liked the record, but we weren't quite sure.
Which record are we talking about here?
This is Thriller.
Thriller.
Now, am I right to say...
Thriller, yeah. I mean,
it's great. Off the Wall had come up. It's like, Off the Wall, I remember I reviewed it for Sounds. Gave it a really good review.
It's a great album.
It's a great album, and it was a huge seller over quite a long period of time. And then along comes Thriller, and Epic are having a playback of it around at Soho Square. Does anybody want to go? And I think you were the only person that went. Is that right?
I don't think I went.
Oh, I voted in. You went.
Maybe I did. In that, because I don't even remember it.
Yeah.
But I do know that I thought it was a damp squib. Because I remember...
Thriller.
Yep. I think we all thought that. If we could go back in a time machine, firstly, it doesn't chart that high and it doesn't hang around.
Because it starts with a rubbish single, doesn't it?
It has. The Girl Is Mine.
Oh, The Girl Is Mine with Paul McCartney. That was the first one. That's right.
Sit quietly.
That is bad.
In case Paul McCartney.
Yeah.
Sorry, Paul. He's everywhere.
I remember doing a personal file with Miranda from the Bell Souls, who I always got on well with.
Right.
I always liked her. And we both discussed on the personal file thing how, it's not doing very well, is it, my new Michael Jackson album?
Really?
And remember, it was turned round by the Motown thing. Billie Jean,
Maybe we did that, because I can remember writing up the interview and there was an option for the cover, wasn't it?
Why do you think you got the interview?
Why did we get it?
It needed help.
They were desperate.
Because...
Although it was the last interview he did, apart from one tiny little phone with the Daily Mirror, about 2 years later. It was actually the last interview he did, because after that he didn't need to do one again.
Anyway, that was what I read online about Smash Hits covers. But I guess predominantly it was white people, but I guess pop was probably white.
We're talking about identity.
Yeah. Now, the gay thing's interesting because the gay thing came directly into pop with... Not with Boy George.
No,
who was, as you would now say, closeted.
Yeah.
Having an affair with John Moss. When Dave Rimmer wrote Like the Point Never Happened, and I was kind of editing it, because I'd negotiated for Faber to publish it, Dave put in, quite frankly, about George and John Moss, and I said, I don't think that's fair on them, because they haven't said that in public. He wouldn't back down.
Well, I can remember him coming to the office and writing a piece for Smash Hits, a cover story, and saying that they were having this affair, and we had this debate about whether or not we could publish it.
I think we didn't.
And no, we didn't. We can't do that.
That's the Japanese thing, which David Book was based on.
Yeah.
And John Moss was furious.
It's their business.
He's absolutely furious. But then, of course, Frank Goes to Hollywood come along, and every group, as we all know, had to have an angle.
Yeah.
Frankie Goes to Hollywood were the first group that the gay thing was an angle. And that was outrageous gay.
And there were two of them.
And there were two of them, clony outfits.
So were those two, Paul Rutherford, wasn't it, and Holly, were they the first kind of out?
Yeah.
But before the coming out, probably?
No, you're forgetting, I was about to come on to it. Then that's 83, 84.
Oh, yeah.
84, Bronski Beat appear.
Bronski Beat, of course.
And I do the cover feature.
Yeah, Bronski Beat, that's right.
And that's a big shift because Frankie are doing It's So Outrageous We're Gay. Bronski Beat are doing It's So Normal We're Gay.
Yeah.
Small Town Boy and Tell Me Why are about the contemporary gay experience.
Mm-hmm.
And we put them on the cover in 1984 with the entire gay agenda in the article.
Mm-hmm.
Completely. And that's, although no one even said anything at the time about it.
That's the interesting thing.
Yeah. I remember thinking, well, it's amazing, we're just putting this whole gay agenda, there's no beating around the bush, there it is, and it's all in there. And also it's sort of fresh, because that's what you're always looking for, isn't it?
Yeah.
Something that's fresh.
Even a few years before.
Because Jimmy didn't like... I don't think Frank Goes to Hollywood. I think Holly didn't like Jimmy either. And probably...
Was Smash Hits the first to make that point about it?
I can't say that because I can't remember, because they will have been in the NME.
Yeah.
And the NME did have a sort of left political stance. Yeah. It was very Red Wedge. Although Red Wedge is not as late than that. But that was their, but for us, that was their unique selling point, you know, was the gay thing.
Actually, it was a fantastic decade. It allowed people just to feel, it was accommodating, wasn't it, to all that? You know, you look back at
it was also
Bowie and Elton John, I mean, they were both put in positions where they said things that were kind of untruthful about themselves. They were
Pressure.
Elton John said that he was bisexual, which wasn't true. and David Bowie said he was gay, which wasn't true. He was bisexual. So, you know, they're both...
George Michael said he was straight, which wasn't
true. Which wasn't true.
And we all knew. We all knew. We didn't all know, actually. No, we suspected it. I always suspected it.
Yeah.
And George, boy George, used to have a horrible joke about George Michael. Why is George Michael's got a suntan? I should remember the joke now, sorry. Oh, no, I can't remember the joke. Yeah. Why hasn't George Michael got a girlfriend? Because you can only get one person on a sunbed.
Whose joke was that?
Boy George.
Boy George.
Because Boy George used to say a lot of things about George Michael, and they actually, I believe, became friendly. I remember Fat Tony, the DJ, telling us that he and Boy George had gone onto George Michael's house, and it was really nice, and they all had tea together. So it was all very nice. But nonetheless, it still wasn't. You were still fighting a crusade in those days.
Yeah.
Chris and I went to the famous Pits and Perverts gig in 1984, where the miner strikes on. So I remember all of this stuff.
It's called Pits and Perverts,
where the gays had a benefit concert for the miners, and the miners' wives came.
Is that what that film Pride?
The film Pride ended it. Yeah. And Chris and I were actually at this concert at the Electric Ballroom, and it was quite moving when these miners' wives from the Northeast or something came on and thanked everyone, and Bronski Beat had just played, and there'd been other stuff on. It was an amazing thing. That film's quite a good film, actually.
Right.
Worth seeing. Just because of the meeting of two worlds, this sort of radical London gays and who would call themselves queers now, and the mining.
Yes. Yeah. It's change of the language is the thing throughout the years. It's just constantly, you know, what you can say changes absolutely all the time, doesn't it? Just regularly. Yeah.
It does. It changes. It changes hugely.
Queer. You were talking about skinheads earlier. I don't know if I told you this. When I was in sharing a flat with a bunch of guys in Wood Green in 1970-71 or whatever, one of them came out, was very active gay with the Gay Liberation Front and so forth. Actually, took me down to the Camberwell Tavern in Union Tavern in Camberwell, where there was a skinhead evening populated by gay skinheads. And the DJ called Sugar Boots.
What, when was that?
71.
Wow.
That was going on. This subculture that clearly nobody would... Time Out wouldn't have written about it, let alone, you know, the Evening Standard or whatever.
No, they probably wouldn't. They would have tied themselves up in knots as to how they could write about it.
Yeah.
But it was
By the way, as you mentioned Time Out, this is a discussion Chris and I often have. In fact, Chris mentioned it at lunch today. Why do listings magazines not exist anymore? Because it's not all on the internet. When you bought Time Out in London, you got, you know, your theatre, art, film, etc. listings, the renting flats thing, that's obviously gone. You got the gay listings.
You did.
You got fringe theatre.
Children.
Children. But the gay thing, there it all was on, I think it was just one spread.
Yes,
bit of editorial and then the listings. And it was all there. You could look it all up online, but it's not simple. As a piece of technology, the listings magazine is very, very effective and simple.
And you might be right.
And now it's just all, you go on Time Out's website, and it's the top five diddle-doo-dahs.
I do think Time Out as a print magazine invented contemporary London.
I think so too.
You get sport, children, eating out, dance, clubbing, all the things that people think of when they think of London nowadays in all its, you know, multifarious glory was all invented.
Also, the design? Was it Piers
Marchbank? Piers Marchbank.
Yeah. But going back to what you're saying, I mean, now people just want the bit specific information about the specific thing that they're interested in. But they don't get what you got then.
Why did I go to that?
Oh, I could go see that film.
You used to read context and content at the same time.
Yeah.
And you don't anymore. You zero in the content anymore.
So you say it invented contemporary London. Well, contemporary London is now not being invented. Or is it? And if it is, what's it being invented by?
No, that's a good point.
I don't know, but all I can remember is when I came to London, that was the thing everyone said, get a copy of Time Out, and it will all take off. And it did.
And you rented your flat from Evening Standard.
Yeah. and I finished up writing for them, where you got massive amounts of money. You wrote a caption, I think it was a 175-word caption, and I think you got 17 quid. And that was absolutely ridiculous.
Didn't they give you a day off to recover?
Yeah, probably. Yes. Timeout's office was amazing.
It was good.
Timeout's office had a room where you could just go and collapse if you had a hangover. And they had washing machines where you could do all your laundry. Yeah. The people just arrived, you know, about 11 o'clock, got all their free gifts in jiffy bags, you know, went to some reception, came back, had a snooze. The room where you could have a snooze. Wrote 150 words and went out to a gig. Very nice work. Yeah.
And yet somehow the product was better.
Yeah.
It was good.
So what was your best moment? What was your best moment being a pop star?
It's too wide. I mean... Well, what's come into my head is appearing on Soul Train in America.
There you go.
Wow. That's good.
And being interviewed by Don Cornelius.
Oh, right. Yeah. And then you have the kids dancing behind you.
They had, you know, sort of lead dancers and everyone else.
Yeah.
And Don Cornelius comes over and Chris does quite a lot of the talking, actually. And, why are you guys called, you know, the Pet Shop Boys? And Chris says, oh, it sounds like a hip-hop band. And he says, you don't look like no hip-hop band to me. And Chris goes, what do you mean? And everyone dancing to West End goes, well, your love comes quickly. And he says, well, we like you. You're very cool. And it, just being on that, I think we wanted to be on it because David Bowie had been on it in the 70s.
Yes, he had.
Brilliant.
But it was actually, West End Girls was a huge black in America, played on black radio stations. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I just remember that being a very exciting moment that seemed like you were literally on a different planet somehow.
Yeah.
Because it was like you were in the television, really. That was very exciting. I always remember the moment Dusty Springfield walked through the door at Ad Vision Studios to do the duet.
Right.
And that had taken so long to get her and all the rest of it. And Chris and I, was, there was a little office in the entrance, and Dusty walked through with her secretary, Pat, who she used to stay with in London at that point. And Chris and I sort of tittering, and it was sort of nerve-wracking. And then we had to go and say hello to her, you know. And it was a very thrilling moment. Like, we met Liza Minnelli. We were sent to the Mayfair Hotel, which was staying in a suite, and we went up in the lift and came out of this corridor, and Liza opened the door, and we all burst out laughing.
Yeah.
It was obviously so... the whole thing was so ridiculous.
I remember her...
We all just laughed.
I remember you telling us about meeting Liza Minnelli years ago, and you said that after about 10 minutes, she hooked one arm in Chris's and one arm in yours, and you set off across the road. You said, now that we're best friends, let's do everything together.
It was
very Lizard of Oz.
It is!
Well, yeah, she was quite... it's her. That's her reality.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
but Dusty, that was. I remember you at the Albert Hall. It must be the Brit Awards appearing with Dusty. And that. I mean, you really brought her back, didn't you? I mean, her career was.
You know, I don't think we totally realised that till there's a very good book by Vicky Wickham.
Oh right, yeah.
Is it by Vicky and Penny Valentine? And I didn't know that she was self-harming. She'd been in a mental hospital. She was living in a paper day motel. This is all right before us.
Yeah.
And, you know, nothing... Bob Dylan's Deserve This was just his biggest hit in America, number two in America.
Mm.
And, you know, she came back. She made a couple of albums, one on EMI, one on Columbia or whatever, Epic or something. And then, because sadly, she died quite young. Though, mm. She was even 60.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, she died. You know, in sort of a comfortable way of life, and we were always very proud of that. And also, just a thrill to have that voice on your records. I was regretted we never made a whole album because I still think I always thought we would do that, but then time ran out and it didn't happen.
Another great. Did she only record in short phrases, was that right?
She redid this song for the film Scandal called Nothing Has Been Proved,
yeah.
about the Perfumo affair. And Dusty had this amazing process of arranging the song in her head as it went on. She famously gave... Who produced Dusty in Memphis?
Jerry Wexler.
She famously gave Jerry Wexler Nervous Breakdown. and And the first line of the song is, Mandy's in the papers because she's tried to go to Spain, which is about Mandy Rice Davis. And it's a great intro. Did you see how it played? Massively loud, how she had me hearing, massively loud in the headphones. Got a cup of espresso and a cigarette. And she goes, man, the first syllable.
That's right.
First syllable, man. Okay, let's try that again. And I looked at Julie Mendelson, who's our co-producer, and I thought, I said,
it's going to be a long night.
I said, there's two pages of lyrics. anyway, and I said, and we have to double track it. Anyway, to be fair, the whole thing took 3 days, but it was worth it. It's fantastic, though. And, I mean, really, it's melodically not much of a song, I think, has been proved. And it's almost like a recitative, you know. But she takes the end, and she's thinking, she has several goes, it's like someone doing a high jump. It may be fast. You know, she goes right up, and she does this whole thing. And you just think, wow, it was worth the torture.
Absolutely.
It's just, and then, well, yeah. Dusty, can you track that now? Oh, okay. And actually, she tracks it quite quickly.
Having dealt with loads of people like that, you know, TV shows or making records together or whatever, have you come out with more respect for the professionalism of people?
Oh, yeah. I think, you know, it's like I hate it when people call actors lovies, because it's a put down. When you work with people and you see what goes into putting on the show, actually, when I know what goes into it, I put on our shows these days as well. You really, really respect people. Also, you respect. You just think singing must be really easy, because it's sort of a natural thing. Well, it sort of is easy in a way. In other ways, it's not easy, because you've got to think about phrasing. And I suppose people who aren't singers don't think about phrasing. Mm. Sometimes people who are singers don't think about phrasing. And so you do get much more. I learned a lot about singing with recording the very few songs you did with Dusty Springfield. Because Trevor Horn had the thing that every chorus and every verse has got to be different, which we probably still stick to. But Dusty did that with just the vocal. Every verse and every chorus is different. And that's a lot of inventiveness and thinking
that's
about
the music. I never thought of that.
No,
just gives the whole song a different texture and yeah.
You know, if you listen to, you know, it's always different, you know. And Liza Minnelli, you know, wasn't really a recording singer, though she did make records, but she's got the amazing live thing, you know. And David Bowie, when we did Hello Space with David Bowie, I've told the story 1 billion times. He had the song Hello Space Boy, which was kind of a noisy thing on his album, but I always thought it.
Which you did on the Brits, didn't you?
You did it on the Brits.
Yeah, I remember.
But it had.
He was wearing amazing high heels.
By Catherine Hamlet, yeah. And it had two of his great themes, sexual ambiguity and space, in the same song. And so Chris did a new backing track, and we took bits from other tracks on the album, funny enough. And then Chris said, well, there's only one verse, you're going to have to write another verse. And he said, all right, I know David Bowie would cut it up. And anyway, so we thought, oh, that's a good idea, so we cut up Space Oddity. And Bowie phones, how's it going? Yeah, well, there's only one verse, you know. So we've cut up a verse from Space Oddity, Silence. Oh, okay. Anything good? I said, well, I hope so. He said, yeah, sounds like it better come in. And then he's not very happy about it at all. And he came in, we played him the demo and he loved it. And he said, but you've got to sing it. But anyway, so suddenly I am sitting behind the recording desk with David Bowie at the microphone. Well, I mean, as I can still remember David at the Dorchester. It's quite a moment, really. And he says, what voice do you want? And I said, Cockney. And he goes, hello, Spice Boy.
Yes, he does. That's right, yeah.
It's such a great... And by the way, he knows it's funny, too. Yeah. Don't think he doesn't know it's funny as well as he does. It's really, really funny. I remember we did the Brits. You mentioned the Brits. We did the Brits with them. I sat and watched the rehearsal with David Bowie. Which by that point seemed like a perfectly normal thing to be doing, by the way. And David Bowie's commenting on everyone. And we watched Michael Jackson's rehearsal of Earth Song. You know, it looks like a scene from Les Miserables.
Was it this is that's the year Jarvis Cocker?
This is the Jarvis Cocker, and David Bowie turns over and rehearsal and goes, repellent. And then Oasis rehearse. And David Bowie turns over and says, parochial. And then we, anyway, then we're all at the show's back. He's standing, I'm sat backstage, we've all got ready. And David Bowie's wearing the high heel shoes.
Yeah.
And he's eating a ham baguette for his dinner. And I'm chatting to him. And then Chris approaches, and he's got a friend with him. And Chris says, entirely audibly, oh, there's David Bowie. I suppose I should say hello. David Bowie chuckles ruefully and says, hello, Chris. And Chris's friend, Brutler, who's with blushes. It was really, really funny. It was really funny.
Fantastic.
Did you and I, apropos of nothing, did you and I go see Joni Mitchell at Wembley?
I thought I went with Birchie, but maybe we all went. Because it was 1983. It was a great concert.
It was a great concert.
I mean, I'm a huge Joni fan. In fact, funny enough,
I think we did.
Yeah, I remember going. It was the only time I've ever seen her. I met her, of course, famously one of Chris Heath's books. It was Oscars night in LA, and we were about to play in LA. And in our hotel, the Mondrian Hotel, there was an Oscars party. And you know, we used to have this guy working for us. I think he met called Denton. Black guy. He was very, you know, when we went in, suddenly Denton just grabs me and says, Stephen, I want you to meet Neil. And Stephen says, love your music. It's Steven Spielberg. And he's with Mickey DeLenz.
Oh, fantastic. Woo!
Anyway, and I say, oh, God, Joni Mitchell's here. Anyway, 20 minutes later, Denton suddenly brings Joni Mitchell and sort of dumps her down in front of me. And she's had quite a lively evening because I think she's had a few drinks. And I said, oh, I love your music. She says, oh, yeah, I like your videos. And I thought, bitch.
That's a bit catty, isn't it?
And
did you melt and tell her how much you...
Anyway, I did. Anyway, she wasn't... Yeah, I could tell she had other agendas to follow that night. And anyway, it was a thrill to meet her. I have to say, it was a thrill to meet her. She looked wonderful.
Right.
She looked really sort of... Joni and sort of sexy and was...
Dave and I both have signed pictures by Joni Mitchell.
I just have mine reframed.
Yeah.
It's a print.
She was slightly down the dumper at one period, but she put on a
I take mine to be replaced.
Yeah. Oh, I remember...
We went to the...
That was probably around about...
I remember whoever doing the PR, it wasn't BC, at Warner's, had heard that I liked Joni Mitchell and And Joni Mitchell fans were thin on the ground.
They were.
So we got free tickets, of course.
Yeah.
But I didn't get a signed picture.
We got a signed picture.
We got it through.
My youngest son has it in his flat.
We, of course, met ABBA.
We did.
It's a picture. It's a terrible picture. I think it's even online somewhere.
It is.
Jonathan Morris is probably.
It's a fantastic.
Jonathan.
I've annoyingly got my eyes closed. You know.
Yeah.
Just because you blinked at that moment, we all look pissed.
We do. I think I'd gone there to interview ABBA for the Smash Hits Flexi Disc. I can remember. I think that's what it was.
Well, no, but they had a reception.
It
was for the Greatest Hits.
Yes,
it was. It was a strange church still there.
Yes.
Off Sloane Street.
Yeah.
But I went with Birchie. It's very unprofessional. When Birchie, Ian Birch, interviewed Frida for her solo album, she was at the Dorchester. It keeps returning to this conversation. And I said, oh, can I go with you? So both of us went. And really, I just sat there while Ian interviewed Frida, and she was so glamorous. And she was like something out of a Bergman movie. She says, yes, you know, I live in an island off the coast of Stockholm. It's very quiet. Sometimes I might fly to Paris to buy some clothes. And I thought, oh, God, this is so glamorous.
That's a song, Neil.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And you've got a new record out.
We've got a new record
out. I love the track. I have to say, there's a track on there called, I think it's called New London Boy, and it reflects back to what we were talking about earlier, because it's about you, I presume, about you coming to London.
It's me, about coming to London, that's
and listening to Roxy and listening to Bowie and yeah. being frightened of skinheads and all that.
No, it's all really good.
I love your songwriting stories.
Thank you. No, it's
storytelling is awful.
I keep saying, journalists, it takes place between verses 2 and 3 and being boring. Because being boring is about coming down to London, then it goes to the present.
Yeah.
So this is having come to London, what it's like.
Yeah.
Because when you first come to London, you're 18, I was sharing the flat with two friends in Tottenham.
With your copy of Time Out in your back pocket. With
a copy of Time Out.
In Tottenham.
Tottenham, Mount Pleasant Road, Tottenham.
Yeah.
324 Mount Pleasant Road. Actually, weirdly, last year, on the spur of the moment, I looked it up. And the house we used to live in was for sale. It was funny. I thought, well, I can buy the house we used to live in. I don't need to live in Tottenham. And it was really exciting because we came down from Newcastle. We moved to Tottenham. And the street we lived on was almost entirely black.
Mm-hmm.
And to us, this was incredibly thrilling. And all reggae pumping out of
everywhere. Yeah.
And it was really, really...
So what year are we talking about then?
73.
Right.
Beginning of 73. And, you know, we had dyed red hair, and I went to...
You had dyed red hair?
Dyed red hair. I was a huge Bowie fan.
That's a Bowie thing, yes.
I went to North London Polytechnic in Kentish Town, and we went to both David Bowie's last concerts, Hammersmith Odeon, which was... It was some 3 times in that tour, actually. What was
your reaction to his announcement?
Oh, I turned around to my friend when he said, this is the last concert we're going to do. I turned around and said, as if. How right I was.
Yeah.
But actually, he would say, well, I was just saying that about Ziggy Stardust. It was a very exciting time in London in those days. We used to get dressed up on Saturday nights and get the bus to Seven Sisters Tube Station, go running down the new Victoria Line escalator, and we used to wear platform shoes. We used to wear women's shoes sometimes because we'd have a competition to see who could wear the highest heels. And so you'd have size 6.5 women's shoes with your feet crammed into the end of it, and you'd go crashing down, the noise it made, crashing down the escalator. At Seven Sisters, and get off at Oxford Circus and go to Neil Street, the club that became the Roxy,
right,
which was a gay club called Shagaramas.
Shagaramas,
but it was actually spelt
Schwag.
Was it
Shagaramas? Yes, it was Spanish or something.
And it had a picture of a sheep, which was what was the Shagaramas reference, and it was what we used to call in those days Jushy. It was before gay men all grew moustaches and sort of wearing check shirts. So it was the glam rock period where everyone's wearing Oxford bags and silk shirts, and it's very flouncy. And it was really, really expensive. But it was where I first heard a 12-inch record.
What was that?
What was it? Can you remember?
Pop was Rolling Stone.
Yes.
Oh, amazing.
The first one. Speed of Truth. I thought that was the one before it.
Oh, well, it's not what I heard. I'm just saying what I heard.
Yeah, okay.
But they played, you know, the whole, we had that album in the flat. The whole side, one's whole side was Popper's Rolling Stone.
Probably, yeah.
It was like took you on a journey, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And it sounded amazing. Really, really, really amazing. It was very, I remember hearing Walk in the Wild song the first time.
Fantastic.
As a dance record.
Yeah, yeah.
And we on Saturdays we used to go to Bieber, which just opened, the big Bieber store opened in Kensington High.
The old Darien Thomas
building. The old Darien Thomas. And you couldn't afford to buy anything.
I went there, and the staff were so unbelievably cool, weren't they?
And you could buy...
So, frankly, unfriendly.
But you would buy a can of beans.
Yeah.
A friend of mine still got a can of Bieber beans.
Alison's still got a pair of Bieber tights still in there at the packaging.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah. Never.
There's going to be a show at the V&A, I think.
That's got to be worth something, isn't it?
Yeah, not as much as it is worth having at home.
Yeah, it is. It's a cultural artifact.
It's
a great cultural artifact.
Fantastic.
So you're not going to retire?
Well, are you?
No.
That's
a good answer.
I was thinking, because you put up a post on Instagram when we did the Radio Times.
Right.
Well, that was only last year, wasn't it?
It was last year.
And you told us, and Chris and I were frankly amazed that it was going on the cover of the Radio Times. I didn't believe you. I thought, it just can't be. And then there we were. And you posted that saying, I think if we'd known about this 40 years ago,
we'd
both be surprised that we're still in.
But why should you retire if Willie Nelson is 90 and still talking? Which is,
I think
you'd retire
if you'd lost interest. We have, you know, it's... I keep reminding people I'm nearly 70. There is an energy issue sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, we're going on tour in the summer where we're still on this tour we're doing, we've still got Australia and New Zealand to do, and Japan to do. We toured North America with New Order, but we're going to do our own tour at some point. So there's all these things looming on the horizon.
You're in such a wonderful position that people really want to hear the recent songs. They don't just want to hear things you did in the 80s and early 90s or whatever. They just want to hear all the way through.
No, it's... it's not. We just recorded an interview with Weiland for his Radio 2 show. And he knew the Pet Shop Boys because of his mother. And his three Pet Shop Boys songs, you probably won't even know, were Miracles, Flamboyant and Minimal, which are from between 2003 and 2006.
Yeah.
And I thought that was.
But isn't that a reflection of how people consume popular music nowadays, which is completely divorced from the original whatever its original context was? So my children of 30s and 40s, they know all the pop music in the world. They have no idea what order it came in. Absolutely no concept. Whether Elvis Presley was before the Beatles.
That's right.
They've grown up with it all being there. It's all about...
Well, no, it's the thing about pop songs. The whole world of the pop song is a giant, ever-expanding artwork of all of these songs. How many thousands of songs do we know the words to? More or less know the words to? And they come and go in and out of fashion, and sometimes if you look, it's an obscure one that gets shot to fame. But it's an amazing and creative endeavour. People go on and on writing these songs that, in a way that they didn't in the 18th century.
No.
Or even the 19th century, where songs were either folk songs or drinking songs, or art songs like Schubert. Whereas now...
But songs had a different purpose, though.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, the purpose. Yeah. There's endless commentary on life, which I sort of
and
think is one of the main functions.
Tell stories.
Yeah. I mean, it's an amazing thing to be part of as well.
Yeah.
I know you were saying people do... But, so it's good people want to hear new songs, because, I mean, I like the old songs, but... You couldn't just do that, otherwise it would just be a heritage. I mean, people would call us a heritage band, probably. But, you know, the new album we made, which was really easily made, because Chris and I wrote a million songs in lockdown, and Chris got me to start programming, which I've never done before, so I could record vocals. We wrote a million songs, and we just whittled them down to 10, and we asked James Ford to produce it, who's, you know, very de jure, and, of course, a fantastic musician. And I said, he won't want to do it, though. Anyway, we met, and he liked the songs we did. It was all really easy. I don't know. No album is so easy to make as this one. And it sort of has this freshness to it, I think.
Oh,
I think.
So what number album is it?
It's, I'm afraid, number 15. And as I've said to you before, I always remember you saying in the Smash Hits office when a new Elvis Costello album came and saying, I'll review it, but how many Elvis Costello albums does anyone need?
Yeah.
I agree with that. I can agree with that about us.
Playing the demos of your first singles on the little cassette machine in Smash Hits office.
And I was too... that was before Bobby O. Yeah.
Before Bobby O.
Yeah.
And you were too embarrassed to play the one with the rap on it.
Oh, that was after Bobby O. Right after you recorded Bobby O. I was too embarrassed to play the one with rap because I was rapping. And it was Scoffer, David Bostock, who kindly had two cassette machines at home. And he was very good at making cassettes. And so he made the Pet Shop Boys demo cassettes. Scoffer did it. And Scoffer came in and said, I love the one with the rap. I said, really? Because I liked what became the B-side. It was called Pet Shop Boys, which, to be fair, they did end up playing in the Camden Palace because it sounded sort of funky in New York. And he said, no, it's that's the one. That's the one. It's great. And so I then got over my embarrassment about it. But I was definitely embarrassed.
But whenever I hear it, I can still remember hearing it being played back on. The only speaker we had at the time was in the answer phone machine. I think the actual cassette player had broken. We played it back on the answer phone machine speaker.
Oh, really?
I remember thinking, it's a bit tinny, but it's quite good.
Yeah, no.
You never know.
Well,
it might take off.
It was an amazing thing because the Bobby O thing, you made Bobby O single the Fortnite Smashers. Because everyone was brainwashed into liking Bobby O.
Yeah, because you wasn't all about
it. I just played it. All. I had control of the record player.
You did.
So I played Bobby O all day long.
I'm so hot for you.
I'm so hot for you.
Fantastic record.
Still a good record.
Yeah, it is a great record.
Yeah. He had a few good singles, actually, Bobby O. And also, the weird thing is, the weird place under the NME, the sort of novelty shop.
Yeah.
Cascade.
Yeah, Cascade.
Legs waving.
Yes. There were legs, but there were boots.
Like doing the can-can. they had a DJ. He used to play Bobby O. Because I remember come walk down the road and can't promise you to hear it. I'm so hot for you coming out of there. But it was great, the Bobby O smash. It was great when you made Bobby O's Record of the Weekend smash.
Did that give you an excuse to meet up with him in New York when you were going over?
Well, who did... Do you remember there was a label called something like PRS? It wasn't PRS. It had been Pi.
Oh, PW...
something like that.
It's not P. Waterman's company.
No, that's PWL, yeah.
Yeah,
I remember phoning up the...
PRT.
PRT, very good.
Yeah.
And I remember phoning up the PR there, who... Because I like dance music. And those days, there was wasn't many journalists to plug dance music to. And I said, you know, I'm going to New York. I want to meet Bobby O. I may have claimed I was going to write something about him.
I'm sure you did.
But we didn't, in fact. The only person who ever interviewed Bobby O
was Kimberly. Smash Hits.
Kimberly wrote a piece for the Face.
Oh, really?
The only piece I know about is Bobby O.
On Smash Hits,
It was Kimberly Lasson. Because when we went to New York to do the American Smash Hits, Kimberly and I were both there. And Kimberly got to know Bobby O. And he really liked her, actually. And he would phone up. It was a joke in the office.
Fantastic.
Kimberly, darling.
You know? Yes, it was.
anyway, so it was sort of all mad. It's made me look back.
You met him on the... Like, and I often try and reconstruct this, because I was out there with Steve Bush, with a view to seeing Felix Denham with a view to Smash Hits being published in the United States. And at the same time as you were there, Police,
Shea Stadium.
But really wanted to see Bobby O. So you went to Bobby O Friday lunchtime. I think I've got this right.
Yes.
And then you were in touch, and I said, come to the Mayflower. Well, not the Mayflower, Gramercy Park Hotel. Me and Bushy are there. Come over. And you arrive there. 6 o'clock, summer evening.
Gorgeous.
I could still see
hot
the sun glinting.
Yeah.
In. We got back in there. They put me in a suite.
They did, yeah.
And I'd ordered a load of cold beers and a huge and catering packs of crisps.
Yes.
And you arrived, and we went, Neil. And he said, "I've been to see Bobby O, and you'll never guess." I said, "What?" He says, "He wants to make a record with me."
and we just laughed.
I remember you saying you just went, you said it was the most delirious moment.
We were mad. Delirious from
the world. Terrible. Doing smash hits in America. Absolutely. Neil was making a record in America.
It was the whole just world.
And I stayed.
You stayed?
For two more days. We all had lunch with Felix Dennis.
And Mick Farren.
Mick Farren, I do remember that, although I always forget about it. Yes, Mick Farren.
Yeah.
Very tall of the counterculture. And
we're all in New York with you and Bushy doing this outrageously bad American accents just to annoy me.
I'll probably still do that. I do that to our manager, who's American. No, that was a real, God, talking about a turning point in your life.
Absolutely. So when was that?
That was
go on.
July 1983.
Okay.
Because the following month,
40.
Chris and I go to New York, end of August. Unbelievably hot New York. And suddenly we're in unique studios in New York where Arthur Baker, one of our musical heroes, is in the studio next door doing the Planet Patrol album. And Bobby O requires Chris and I to start playing something. And we've just written this instrumental. And Chris plays the bass line, I'm playing the strings on a keyboard. And I say, oh, you know, that rap I wrote, it fits over this. And so we record that, and they go, and Bobby O's programmed the drums, are playing along to him. And he says, okay, let's do the vocal. And so I go behind the microphone, and I do West End Girls for the first time. It's Bobby O, it's a Bobby O session. There's only one take. And that becomes the vocal of the first version. I do it once. And I remember the assistant engineer, a woman called Tracy, said, oh, your voice is so easy to listen to. And we played it back, and I thought, God, there's sort of God singing this song. But Bobby O, everyone, it was, but what Chris and I were annoyed was, it didn't sound like Bobby O. We wanted, that's what we wanted. And we sort of got one in the end from, but yeah.
Oh, God.
Anyway, are we waffling now?
Fantastic.
We
should wind up.
Yeah, we should. Oh, it's so nice to talk to you.
No, it's lovely. Lovely to talk to you both. Yes.
Thoroughly enjoyable. Yeah. And yes, and well, as we would always say, good luck with the tour.
Good luck with the new album.
Yes.
And when the next one's out, come back and tell us all about it.
Lovely to see you.
Lovely to see you.
Fantastic.
Thanks for having me.
Okay.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.